Welcome to Nosecast, the Gnostic podcast, with the Reverend Troy Pierce, where questions make heretics. Views expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker.
Ring a bell that still rings.
Well, if we can go ahead and get started. Looks like we're going to be without working microphones tonight. So, can you hear me back there? Okay. Not everybody. Looks like they're almost entirely new people from last week. A few people have come back, so apparently it wasn't completely horrible. And I'd like to welcome you to the second of this series of three seminars. We're examining the Da Vinci Code phenomenon and our culture, and looking at what we can make of it through the lens of sacred stories, and looking at the stories and what they mean, and what they evoke, how they have evoked this response. This is the first of a series of seminars. The next seminar will probably take place in February. Can't schedule that far in advance. And that will be Exiting the Matrix, Gnostic exploration of the Matrix films. I invite you to check on the website and find out when that's going to be. Well, to get started, let's do a little review of last week, since most of you weren't here. Essentially, what we have in the novel, The Da Vinci Code, and to a lesser extent in the film, are interwoven stories. And they are stories that essentially come from different places. They have different origins, and yet they have points where they connect. And what the author has done, what Dan Brown has done, he's seen these connections and woven these stories together to make a very compelling tale. These are the Holy Blood, Holy Grail type of stories. These originated in the 80s as a work of some researchers, filmmakers for the BBC, looking at some interesting symbolism and so forth in France, and came up with a new connection between these symbols and this treasure story, and that new connection was a bloodline of Jesus Christ from a marriage between Christ and Mary Magdalene. The second story he weaves through is the shadow story of Christian origins, and this has a basis in history, although the details as given in the book are incorrect. One of the things that many people found surprising was that early church history, Christian church doctrine, was determined in a political manner. It was determined in councils. It was determined by votes. And this happened not just once, but many times. That in formulating an orthodoxy, in determining a doctrine, this had to be determined collectively, had to be determined, in a sense, objectively, outwardly, in a form that could be seen and agreed upon, and that this had to be revisited every time somebody got a new idea that may or may not jive with the current doctrine. And so, the initial formation of orthodoxy came from a distinction, a separation out of what was declared as Gnosticism. So it was a very varied movement. and a creation of this one way. Orthodoxy just means the right way. However, taking that strategy, you then have to revisit again and again and declare new things heresy, because the story and the history and people's understanding never stay static. They always change, grow, and develop. So new understandings, new stories will sprout out, and some will be included in the Orthodox story and Orthodox doctrine. Others will be split off, declared heretical, and left behind. The third major story movement, this is all backstory to the thriller mystery plotline of the novel, is the goddess movement story. And this can be seen as more of a mythic story, an understanding of a loss of the sacred feminine from a time in which there was a very real presence, if not a very matriarchal orientation, and that this loss led to the current unbalance in the world, to wars, to persecutions, and so forth. And the way in which we can determine that these are interwoven stories, these are not one story, is that they don't match up at every point. And the big place where they don't match up in the Da Vinci Code is the assertion that Jesus was not considered divine until it was done so by the Council of Nicaea, and also the importance of Mary Magdalene as a figure. These don't jive. They don't connect. And that is one of the more obvious places where we can see this interweaving occurring. The reason it's not more obvious when you read it is that you are being carried through a story that is involving with murder mysteries and codes and all sorts of other information. And so this backstory is given to you a bit here, a bit there, and so forth. And you really have to go back through and look at it and pick out these different threads and see where they don't actually connect. The way in which we understand almost everything, the way in which human cognition works, is stories. We frame our understanding, we pass on our understanding through stories. We can also pass on our experience through stories. This is a variation on an original schematic from Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And it's just a reminder of where stories come from and where stories go. In our day-to-day life, we have normal, mundane stories, and you usually know where they come from. They come from going to the grocery store, talking to a friend or something. But the stories that really resonate with us come from a deeper place. These are the sacred stories, which Joseph Campbell called mythology, to show that it had a pattern that was deeper than any particular telling. And where these stories come from is human experience. There's an experience, there's a process, a journey, which leads to some sort of a transformation. The hero is changed, there's a new understanding, something transformative occurs. Now, if that is the end of this, the end of the story, well, it's good for whoever went through it. They had a transformative experience, but they have in a way of passing that on, conveying that to anyone else. It's in a way of encapsulating your experience and handing it off. So the way human beings have always passed these things on are through stories. And so you tell the story of how you came to this transformative experience, and from that telling, someone else might be able to take that story and use that story as their own process through that journey and through the transformative experience to some extent. It isn't the original experience necessarily, but it is an echo of it, a retouching back to it. So the most important things and our most important understandings are formed in stories. And the ones we hold dearest as a culture, as individuals, are sacred stories. Now, what happens once a story is told isn't a simple thing. It isn't easy to then just take it and follow it back, try to have that transformative experience, try to get through that same process and journey vicariously. It's really hard to do that. And so there's also a tendency to, once the story is told, you then have a story. You have a story out here in the objective world you can then retell and you can do things with. And so from that experience, from that important transformative experience, you then have a story. And if the story has that ability to lead somebody else to a transformative experience to any degree, then they will probably retell it. However, simply being retold does not give you much of an experience, and it also doesn't give it much of a permanency. So you have a tendency to write it down and also to reenact the story. And we see this in early Christianity as something going to a retelling, then a reenactment, and then going to a ritual, a symbolization, a symbolic form of that. And this is the Last Supper. In the letters of Paul, he speaks of the agape feast, the love feast, but this more transcendent type of love, loving kindness feast. And he actually speaks about, refers to people complaining that when others came late to this feast, there were some who had come early who were already gorged themselves or were drunken. And so this was really a feast, really was a meal. You would get your food, get your calories, and that's what it was. So this was a reenactment of Last Supper that was redone centuries. The form, as it progressed, became more and more symbolic, became a ritual form. And instead of everybody just getting together and having some food and trying to, from that, touch back to this initial experience, this transformative experience of Christ, instead of trying to do that by eating some chicken and biscuits, you have a symbolized, a ritualized meal where everything else is stripped away. The extraneous stuff of a meal is stripped away, and you are left with just the body and blood in the form of wine and bread. And this becomes entirely a symbolic meal in that there aren't a whole lot of calories there, but its entire focus is to point you back to the experience. The other thing that happens to stories is that they become written down, edited, collected. You end up with different collections and can end up with canons. And what this can lead to, and also what ritual can lead to, is to formalization. That is an abstract understanding of what the story is. So instead of it being an experience, a reenactment, or a ritual, becomes history, becomes theology. It has an objective, abstract meaning that doesn't require you. View this almost as a dichotomy of how one approaches a story, and this gets at the stories that we tell about stories and the frames in which we understand stories. If we look at it as formalized, it becomes that abstract objective, distant thing, comes history, comes something far away. Also, there's a tendency to have, the orthodox, the one right way of viewing this. So there's a tendency to have one meaning to the story. So the story told about the story becomes what the story means to everyone. There's also a tendency to view the real in a particular way. Since it is objective, it is abstract, it doesn't depend on individuals for its meaning, there's also a tendency to view the physical, to view matter as being real. So the story becomes rooted in the physical, in the material, in the history. And to accomplish this, and to continue it this way, you need to have some control over the original story. You can't have somebody going in and changing it all the time, because that would mess everything else up, because everything else is layered on top of that original story. So you have a canon. You have a limit. You have a book. Its cover, it's closed. You don't add more to that book. Instead, you add other books. The other approach, where one views a story as means to experience, is something to be experienced. And the story becomes a guide, something to be followed, a journey, a path to be tread upon. It isn't something that you can distance yourself from. It doesn't have meaning apart from you. You are a part of the story. And the story is within you. And it doesn't come to its completion until you live out the story. That is yours as well. Since you are a part of the story, there is no out there objective abstract meaning we can all agree upon, because our experience is a part of its meaning. Our transformation is a part of its meaning. We are a part of its meaning. And there is a tendency in this train of thought to view what is being real or what is being important as being that interior transformation, the psychological, the psychic, so that an outward event may be miraculous, it may be cool, but it doesn't have any meaning. I don't really get any experience out of it. Where something that happened in history distantly might be a nice thing, but I don't get that connection to it. So the emphasis is exactly the opposite. It's on psychological, on subjective. And then there is a further tendency to be open with retellings of the story, or new interpretations of the story. What Irenaeus, the first heresiologist writing against the Gnostics, called their tendency to create enormous fictions. Because if it is something to be experienced, and you then experience it, you have a new story to tell, to convey that experience to somebody else. And it may have almost everything in common with the previous story, or may have very little in common. You only have the characters in common, the setting. And this new story, in this view, is as valid as the previous story if it can lead you to that experience. So, I'll stop and remind people to interrupt me. Comments and questions and considerations. It's no pelting me with any kind of rotten fruit, fresh fruit, all like this. Any questions so far? Comments? Where this takes us, as far as the Da Vinci Code goes, is we have these compelling stories that I outlined before. And these have sparked the imagination, really, millions of people, in some way or another, either positively or negatively. And last week we talked a little bit about people's reactions, positive and negative. Since we have new people, how many positive reactions to the book? Come on, you can do it. Any negative reactions to the book? Neutral, mixed. Yeah, it's quite a mixed bag of things. And the stories that it tells are open to refutation because the details of the stories as laid out in the novel are almost entirely incorrect. But the form of the stories has a resonance. So you can have two people cross-talking, arguing about the novel, as has happened many times, one saying that it reveals some truth, shows something new, the other one saying that it's all just incorrect lies and fallacies. And they can both be correct. It's the problem when what evokes these things is such a complex mixed bag and is really kind of this subtext to a story that has been described as an airport read or a beach read, that you have a very mixed bag. And the result of that is a lot of mixed reviews, mixed understandings. However, we want to dig deeper than all that and look at why we have these views, why we have these understandings, why these reactions occur. So what is compelling about these stories?
So when you say story, you speak of the story, you're actually making sort of three distinctions, if I'm understanding. There's a story which is based upon historical fact, things that happened in time, and people tell tales about that type of story. Then there's a second type of story, which may come from an inner vision or understanding, and that story one tells from a source of imaginative power than one's own self, based upon an experience. And it may have nothing to do with anything that happened outwardly. Is that, you talk about the different types of stories happen. And there's a third type in which the inner transformative event may actually claim the source in the history and reread it as history. So what might happen? Something happened on the inside, and then they take the figures who have names in history, make them the players in the plot.
Yes.
So you have really three things here. You have, say, a history of Jesus of Nazareth, the Mary Magdalene, and the possibility of their historical existence, and tales told that are trying to root at the nature of that historical existence. You have a second type of story, which might be an entirely visionary story, that might have entirely new ideas, entirely new images, an entirely new construct, unrelated in any way to anything historical. Then you might have a third type of story, which is visionary in a sense, it's one's own revelation, but the characters that play the story are the historical individuals, and so there's this metamorphosis of what was history and what is story about personal history. Is that?
I would say that that's a good breakdown of sacred stories. Stories in general are even broader in that they are merely forms and encompassments of understanding, meaning, or experience. But sacred stories do have those three understandings. Those are stories that we tell about sacred stories. And they're impulses from which these stories come from. But even the historical understanding of the sacred story would say that even that has to have a transformative event involved with the people there. It wouldn't be an interesting story that would be told and survive through, particularly in ancient times, across distance and across history. So I think every one of these points to experience, but they all do have a different emphasis and a different story told about them, a different frame in which they are understood. That makes sense. Anybody else? One of the compelling stories is this recent one that had quite a stirring up in the 80s, which is the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which points towards not only a marriage between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, but also a continued bloodline that survived and got involved in a lot of other things in history that are quite interesting, largely because they really couldn't have happened. The reason that conspiracies tend to intrigue us so much is because large-scale, long-term conspiracies pretty much guarantee to be fiction. It's hard to keep a very small conspiracy going, and these large stories that are told of conspiracies don't really point to human action so much as these backstories within us, these psychological stories, these mythic stories that come through us, and that people touch upon again and again across time and across space. And so instead of there being a transmission of the secret, there is a transmission of symbols and of stories that are important to people that come from human experience and that are told. And these have connections, similarities across time, across space. And if you look at them in a particular way, you can make those connections and see it as a code. Jung made a distinction between signs and symbols. Symbols being more of an opening into something deeper, something richer, more akin to art, great painting. Whereas a sign, it'll be more like a traffic sign. It only has one meaning. It only expresses one intent. And what has happened with the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and these related books is seeing these connections and seeing them as a transmission, seeing them as having to be connected informationally, horizontally, across time, across space. Whereas there is this other element called the vertical element, where the symbols can also come from deep within us. It can be refound, reinvented, re-experienced. Symbols don't have to be transmitted one person to another. A person can dream of a symbol that hasn't been present in their culture thousands of years. And that indicates something about our human makeup of our psychology, of our cognition, who we are as human beings. Well, this story is the story of a marriage. And it changes the story of Christ from a story of the death and resurrection to a story of a marriage and a child. And this has had an appeal. Whenever you bring two things together, essentially look in two different directions for something to come of it. You can look for sort of the creative, the procreative, the repetition in a new way and a new theme. Or you can look towards something transcendent, a synthesis that goes beyond the two that came into union. And what we have in the story of Mary Magdala and Jesus being married is sort of a sacred union. And one of the authors who propagates this theory really calls it a hieros gamos, refers to it as such, and sees it as being this sacred marriage that is an archetype, a form through which we can all experience a unity, some sort of a sacred unity. The story is not a new story. This is actually a retelling and a recasting of an old myth with new characters. And many of the authors of these works who look at this are conscious of this. They see this as being the story of Isis told again. And that this is really a mythic theme that is repeated in Christian literature, in Christian stories and myths. And there are those who go so far as to say that since this is a way in which we can understand this, therefore there was no historical basis. There is only this mythological understanding, so archetypal understanding. There couldn't have been real people involved because the pattern of the story is one we can recognize. Well, that's very much a fallacious argument. You see many biographies, usually ones of an earlier generation, that even the stories of historical figures for which we have untold amounts of data can be told in a mythic form. And the reason they're told in a mythic form is that's how we understand them. That mythic story is within us. The hero story, these particular ways, the quest, the hieros gamos, overcoming adversaries, all of this is something we understand as it is within all of us. The story isn't laid out completely in front of you in a text or in the telling. That means it's relying on the story within you to complete it. And what we have in the Da Vinci Code is a very sketchy story. And so it really does rely on individuals to complete it. Either those who are familiar with Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the other works, or just that interest that it sparks and where it can lead us within ourselves. An entirely internal resonance with the story. That the story, merely sketched out, is completed within us, and we respond to it. And what we think is responding to something outwardly is really something inward. And this makes sense because if you follow the story as proclaimed, then it really doesn't seem to go much of any place. This story of a bloodline merely begets more and more little Mary Magdalens and Jesuses and so forth. They become kings of France and get killed. And some of them survive, and so what? It doesn't really give us what we're looking for in that sacred union. It's very much a profane union. It's just a normal union between two people who we might think of as historically important, but again, so what? The story told about the story, the understanding in which we frame the story, doesn't really hang together. It doesn't include us, and it doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't really change anything. Now, the reason it seems to be compelling to some is that it would break through other stories that are told about the story. Stories told about Christ in which he is celibate and all the disciples are celibate males and therefore only those four celibate males can be leaders of religions and so forth. But that is a secondary story that has no place in the original story. So we must look, I think, in the other direction for the compellingness, the meaningness, fullness in that story. Look towards the transcendent. This is also a modification of a fairly common schematic. It has its origination in the work of Hegel and appears in the work of Jung. It also occurs in ancient creation myths. And that is, there is some undifferentiated, unconscious something. Doesn't really even know what it is. And then it goes through a process of division to become aware of itself. Or, if someone else is doing this, then we take it through a process of division and separation to see the different elements that are there. That's the meaning of the word analysis. We take things, look at them, spread them apart, see what's there, compare, contrast, and we end up with, in some way, in some form, opposites. Now the task in that point is to you're either stuck there, some sort of grand dualism or minor dualism, or you push forward to the difficult task of synthesis, of recombining these into a new whole that includes separate elements, it includes the understanding and transformation of the analysis, but it goes beyond them, it transcends them. Jung called this the transcendent function, that bringing together opposites, point wasn't to have one over the other, choose one or the other, but to bring them together. And in doing so, in a way, those come together and open up a door to something new. We can see this as being the exact same form as the hieros gamos, that in bringing sacred union, things together, something new is born, something new is created. The truth that lies behind this story and the other stories is that of a separation and a loss and a desire to reclaim that, to reunify that, to have something new come of that. And what we do is we see that backwards. We see that in our sacred stories in the form of a marriage between Christ and Mary Magdalene. That in making that a mythic present, we can claim what has been lost. The other story that is told is that what has been lost has been the divine feminine, or the feminine in general, and that it is through reclaiming the feminine that we have the ability to get to that new story, that new thing, that new understanding, the new birth. You guys gotta interrupt me, you know? Start helping me on stuff. Okay.
In fact, what's your separation of definition of a story and a myth? When I think of a story, to me, it's like a competition that is fictional. I mean, you don't write a scientific exploratory, you write an article, you don't write a story of a discovery.
Well, you actually do, and in some sense, because even in a scientific article, you're laying out the process by which you're going to test these things, and then the results by which you got from them, what you get from those results, etc. And so you are laying out a thread of narrative to give meaning to the data that you're presenting. And we do that in everything that we do, really. There's only in sort of blindly looking out or just receiving raw data is there not a story. It's so ubiquitous that we usually don't notice. And usually we only point it out when it's a fictional story or something. But it really is part of our cognition. Even a summary of data is, in a sense, a story. You're giving it a form that says, you know, what we're looking at is this. This is what's important. This is why we did it, to look at this. So there's some skeletal story involved in anything that has meaning, and that's really the frame that gives that thing meaning. And so there are then, we might say, layers upon layers upon layers of stories, frames upon frames, that give meaning to whatever is within them. And so there's the physical scientific story or frame in which an experiment wouldn't be complete in a way. You wouldn't be able to explain to somebody from another universe without this encapsulation of how all the physical world laws of the universe work. But you don't need that to explain to somebody else in the same field. You just give them the little skeleton of the story, and that's enough for them to understand what you're conveying. Also in like a scientific paper, you're conveying experience. So you are providing a means in which somebody else could replicate that experiment and also gain from your experience directly, merely by reading the story, by going through the process of understanding it. So I see stories as being very general, very generic. Sacred stories are more along the lines of myths in that they have more specific patterns and that they seem to be more that archetypal within us form and that we occur time and time and time again. But we have to hang data together, and it seems that the way we do that is stories. Even like in visual art, if you look at a good great painting or something, there's a story going on there. There's, it pulls you in and you are engaged, and that's what seems to convey the meaning, if that makes sense.
Do you think the author was writing a story about what he thought was a myth?
Well, I think he was exploring his personal understanding, and he seems to have been convinced that these things were true early on, and then to have thought better of it as time went on a little bit. But it does come from his personal understanding, and that's where those connections come from, is from him exploring, seeing these connections, putting them together, and being convinced, having his beliefs then become the backdrop for this other, you know, this murder mystery story and Grail Quest and so forth. And so that's why it seems to be compelling, is that it was compelling to him. Because you can't create these things out of nowhere. You can't just decide, I'm going to make a new myth. You know, you might succeed, but chances are you won't. The reason these things come out of nowhere, blindside cultures like this phenomenon has, is that it comes out of that individual's process, out of his unconscious and his coming to some sort of transformative experience himself. He may not agree with the facts and the beliefs he puts around it, but there's something to it, and that's what he conveys to other people and what they find so compelling, it seems.
But it's fiction. I mean, he wrote it as a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Some idea of it, and putting it together and trying to become a
story. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are definitely a lot of elements, like called cheats and conceits, about the way in which he framed this information, the way in which he tried to persuade the audience that it's true. And that is a part of its popularity. But the way that you persuade people, the best way to persuade anyone, is to believe what you're telling them. It's hard to persuade people if you don't believe it. It's not impossible, but it's harder. And from his early reports and interviews and stuff, just when the book was being released, when he was asked what's true in it, and he says, all of it, he appears to have been convinced of the truth of this stuff, and that he was really on some kind of crusade to reveal the truth, and that is part of what carries people through the novel, I think. It makes it compelling. So it's fiction, but in a way, he's trying to be like historical fiction, in that the backdrop is claimed to be real historical fact. The places and texts are genuine or something. I can't remember what the exact quote is. But there's this playing around with a historicity that really isn't there, but he was convinced of at the time. And I think that's why it's so compelling. And apparently his publishers were, whatever, because if anybody had vetted this book, they would have found all these errors. Or if they found the errors, they decided, well, let's go ahead and publish it, because then people will claim that it's wrong and we'll get more publicity that way. Who knows? But it was, from his perspective, as far as I can tell, some genuine belief and desire to persuade and convince others.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that
it would be synthesis actually Canuccio? Well, no. The Canuccio opens up to this next step. I mean, essentially this is kind of a combining of Hegel and Jung, in that the transcendent function wouldn't necessarily be described as something like this. It might just be like blank, you know. There's no something entirely new. But the yin and the yang seem to be a good way of expressing that it includes these things in the dynamic new understanding. But the kanyukyo can happen in a lot of different ways, the sacred unions coming together of opposites. And the opposites can be many different types of opposites. And really what happens is an initiation of something new. And the form of the something new is radically different from what was there before, the undifferentiated part, and from the opposites. And the exact form, so it says it's new, you're not going to know what it's going to be. Really, that's, if you're looking for something specific, as people often get lured into doing when they're looking for cultural changes or religious changes or things, looking for something specific, then you're not going to find it, because if it's new, it's going to catch you off guard, blindside you. But essentially any coming together, because what that does is it has taken it through a process we've understood it. And that's really the difference between the hieroskamos as portrayed and the yungsho, is that in the hieroskamos as portrayed in the novel and understood by many people, there isn't that process of separation or analysis. There isn't this bringing of consciousness into the action. It can just happen and then something new can occur. Whereas in Jung's understanding, consciousness was important from the very first step. You had to have that separation analysis. You had to break things apart, go through that alchemical process of separation and seeing what the different things were before you could then try to get something new out of it. So you had to really understand, have the experience of what is there, let's say, is to have the gnosis of what is there, as well as the episteme, the factual understanding of what is there. And then you can take the next step through a leap beyond that. It includes conscious bringing together of these things. But it's always mysterious because it's different in every case, and it has to be a transformative experience. So it always includes that journey beforehand in the story to get to that point. And then really that point is always a bit mysterious. It's always symbolic. There's always something there to replace the transformative, the transcendent. You know, there's the grail, there's the resurrection, there's something else. It's not the real experience, because that is just beyond words and cannot be conveyed except through the process of the story, cannot be conveyed in the form of the story. That makes sense. Get what you were interested in?
The comment on what is a story versus a scientific paper? You know, it seems that all history is, in essence, a type of story that is observer-based. Every testimony we have of fact and history comes through observer's eyes. And we all know that several observers of similar facts will often draw conclusions. So, in essence, and if you kind of one goes back before, say, the 14th century, the 15th century, there was really no sense of history as we understand it now. Academic, all history was highly story. And so, whatever happens in history, whatever happens back in past time, what we know of is a story told by observers. And then, but to tie that into like the archetypal thing that you're talking about, Troy, it seems that if observers not only are looking outwardly, but perhaps are pointing outward back by inward perception, the inward perception can mold what it is believed they saw. Mm-hmm. And that's another fact. Jurisprudence, legal evaluations, is often what people see is highly conditioned by some internal perception of what they should see. There's an imagination to see. Or perhaps, at least, the way they divine all the things they did see into a story, some coherent narrative of what happened. So, if perhaps there's this inner thing, which
you might call an archetypal structure that is blossoming out of our imagination. That then grasps hold of externals and brings them into some sort of cohesive unity, which they may never pass externals. But the unity is brought by our imposition, by that archetypal imaginative imposition upon random facts. We look at the stars and we see constellations. The stars are random. The constellations are imaginative position upon them. And so, you know, I just look at Dan Brown, and it's like when he's writing a story, back or not, you have a whole lot of events, and it seems like he caught hold of some of an archetypal structure that you have up there on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't necessarily approach it in a Jungian fashion or a particularly complex psychological fashion. But he sure as hell caught hold of something that you know, was bait for a lot of interest.
Yeah.
And the imaginative hook and the bait, well, the bait is historical fact. The imaginative hook that's holding that bait is really pulling us. Is that that image that something that there are two opposites in the world, that they're seeking unity, and that there's something religious about that. In fact, that may be the center of all religions. And it may not have anything to do with people being put up on crosses and leading a whole lot, the Mel Gibson approach, you know, and passion at all. But it may have something to do with something that's still going on in us, the story that's still going on in us, that is in all of our imaginations. And so, whether he felt that it was true or not, in a sense of concrete historical fact, I suppose the man got to step back and said, no, imaginatively, it's true. It works.
Mm-hmm.
I think it works because it's more of a public history, it's more human. It's like, my reference is Margaret Starker, and she said that she set out to play the ground and blood wrong. She was going to do it wrong. And instead, she proved herself that the history and the facts that she came up with, it was more accurate than she realized. But still, you're saying that that's how she interpreted that's her story.
Yeah. Well, there is a distinction in that. What it takes to convince ourselves of the truth of something is different than what we might use as standards and criteria in history or in scholarship or something. And what's happened with the authors and the scholars who look at the Holy Blood, Holy Grail and stuff is that they really seem to be convincing themselves and then telling that story to everybody else as though it were objective. And so it really is more of this subjective linking together of things and how they became convinced. And in that way, they can become very useful and valuable because that lets you connect to, not only to them, but also to what they're connecting to because you can see the story that they're viewing it through. But it doesn't have that same validity that, you know, an objective history or something would have because the criteria they're using is being convinced themselves.
So.
Some places, other places she flipped open the Bible and read a verse or made some other connections that are inward, right? Which are how you become convinced yourself. But then, you know, if you are proclaiming those as being indicators of historical fact, then you've crossed some weird line or something, you know. So there are things that we can connect to. I mean, these people aren't just all smoking stuff who are Holy Blood, Holy Grail folks. They're seeing things and they're making connections, but the criteria they're using are essentially being convinced themselves in a way. They're not using the standard criteria because that's what makes them fringe scholarship, basically. You know, if you look at the objective historical facts, you don't come up with these conclusions. It's if you are looking for them. There's so few, too.
That would be anyway. But in doing that reading, I was simultaneously, for a while, sitting in the meditation room. Every week, a white man just wrote a book on the four gospels and putting them together in a completely new way. And also studying Kabbalah, which, you know, is a new way, it's actually like parallel to the Kabbalistic studies I do under the Nome School, where he was over here.
Mm-hmm.
But I would listen to his accounts of early Christianity and just so few what they think about is conflicting with this whole book I just spread out and seen such a I don't know. But what's quite clear is that even besides the fringe of alternative scholarship, even academic Bible to biblical scholarship, it reading any of those, like I don't know currently starting now.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to get very far to see that in so many cases it's very opposed to official church history, in fact.
Right.
Now, this is coming out of Yale, Stanford, Northwestern University.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder how none of this, we have not ruined anything in our everyday lives.
Oh, yeah.
And so.
Yeah, the term that. The
old term.
You can kind of speed around how many historical, you know, good machines, like, well, what lessons.
Yeah, the old term is the new scholarship for this new understanding of scripture and history that came out of Germany century before last now. And it really has been present in our professional seminaries for decades. And I've talked to people who've gone through these professional seminaries and they're very interested, like when they meet me and I'm a Gnostic and they want to talk about this stuff. But talking amongst themselves, they would say, well, we can never bring this up to our congregations. That this sacred story is really sacrosanct. It's really off limits. And that's part of the reaction against the book, is that taking on the sacred story in a way and playing with it has really enraged a lot of people because they see it as being such a frame of how they understand the universe. It is, in fact, more the cosmos than the physical laws of the universe. And so to mess with it is to really, really mess with their world, literally. And so there's this.
Actually, all over the place, and the importance of it was the concept of a monarchy that is holding a certain universal doctrines and sacred truth that is their responsibility to, as much as humanly possible and implementable, to maintain in their societies. A lot of, and it was a difference with, say,
I could see that as a being either an archetype or as
ethical. These older and ancient entities in the place of the church appointed monarchs.
Oh, it was a long process, and it really wasn't a direct one for one. It was more of a replacement of the Roman Empire. Yeah, I mean, there was a large, huge cultural shift, and that's part of the goddess movement story that is the tale of something lost. And this reoccurs time and time again, that something has been lost. But the character of what has been lost is always sometimes a little different. The feminine is quite common. And you can see, if you've ever read the rather Gnostic science fiction novelist Philip K. Dick's work Valis, there's this thread through it that is this loss and death of a woman. And it really seems to stretch back to the death of his twin sister, but it's more, it's symbolic, it's deep, and it's a part of his spiritual quest for some sort of a completion. And what it is that we're looking for is just whatever it is that is lost. And we can frame it in different ways and say that it is this older spirituality or it is the feminine. But what we end up doing, however we frame it, is we end up adding things to the lost just because they're lost. Yeah, so the feminine includes things that, if you look at other cultures and other times, really aren't cognitively or linguistically considered to be part of the feminine, although there's a lot of differences there as well across times and cultures. But you end up having, if you tell the story in the way that it's told in the novel, for example, then a lot of things are associated with the feminine that are there associated with the feminine just because they are the lost, just because they are the suppressed or the neglected. So you end up having these different symbols and forms that he associates with the feminine, like the left-hand side, so forth, that are really universal symbols. And like the left-hand side seems to indicate more of something of the unconscious, something of outside of the realm of consciousness, because most human beings, 90%, are right-handed. And so the left-hand side is kind of this less known, less direct form. And as soon as you get to hoplite warfare, which is where actually the left is the sinister comes from, because people who are left-handed were very bad at hoplite warfare, because you had to carry your spear in your right hand and your shield in your left hand, because your shield guarded the person to your left as well as you. And in battle, if you lost your spear or threw down your spear, there would be no mark held against you. But if you lost your shield or threw down your shield, you were guilty of cowardice, because you were not only leaving yourself open to attack, but leaving open the person next to you. And so when you make it into a story of one set of opposites, you end up kind of glomming things together and making a tale that focuses instead on the claims of what it is that is lost instead of seeking what is lost. You're looking for and trying to articulate the lost instead of in the process of actively incorporating, seeking, finding, bringing it into being. And that seems to be another way in which this veers off course. Because if you can really become a fundamentalist or a literalist about any story, including these stories, and people in this world have been, and there are people who have articulated the lost as the divine feminine and have swung things completely over in an attempt to balance things, they've gone out of balance in the other direction. It's most likely that this will come back into balance in the future, but you can see that the way in which we articulate this, the story we tell about what is lost, what is missing, really does impact how we seek it, what we are seeking, and how we go about finding it. And I would just caution from articulating too closely what it is. Because there is what has culturally been lost, there is what has been lost within us. And often we cannot distinguish between the two when we look out at the world and see what is missing. The story of the lost feminine in the novel Valis is a story by a man, and as in the Gospel of Thomas and as in the work of Jung, we seek wholeness, we seek to have neither be masculine or feminine, but incorporate, include, individuate, encompass these aspects of ourselves. And so there is a psychological element, but it resonates with many people, so there is a cultural element. And where these two can be distinguished, it's hard to say. There was a change, and there was something lost. What we can truly point to as being lost is that experiential element. And this kind of two major attitudes and takes on how to approach a sacred story, whether it be rooted in history or not. And that is whether you proceed linearly with it or cyclically with it. Use it to retouch back to the experience. The religious forms that were prevalent in that early Christianity modeled to a large extent the mystery schools, the mystery religions. And these were not mysteries in the hidden sense so much as mysteries in the experiential sense. Mysterion means be initiated, be transformed, to go through something. It's a word for sacrament. And in these traditions, they took place outside of the public eye because they focused on some symbolic experience. What they did was they went for the ritual element. They involved stories, the telling of stories that were prevalent in the culture, but in a ritual way that included the person and the people who were participating in them. One very famous one is the Eleusinian Mysteries, in which the story of Demeter and Persephone. Demeter is the mother, earth mother goddess, harvest goddess. The loss of her daughter Persephone into the underworld was repeated in what is reported as a dumb show. Now, people kept silence on these mysteries, and we don't have a whole lot of information to go on. We do have reports of individuals saying that once they participated in them, they no longer feared death. That this story that was unfolded before them was a ritual act that included this dying in return, Persephone, going to the underworld, freed them of their own fear, death. There was a transformation. They went on a journey in the transformation and were transformed by the story. Early Christianity mirrored this in many ways. It seemed to take a lot of forms from early Mithraism, some symbolism, yet combined it in this new impulse of a new transformative movement. And so these rituals, these mysteries, were conducted very much in the same way as the previous mysteries were, in different parts of the world at different times for a period of time.
It just occurs to me that this is what the aliens are doing. It's a initiation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they were claiming to be. I forget the exact term, but anyway, reconnecting to the earliest form of Christianity in that way, go through an initiatory act. And it's good.
In the basement, all the way out here, the cars is a perfect example of what we've done in the story. And he's that cartoon. It's all on the wall.
Oh, really?
And he's taken a beautiful story and created pictures for creation, for Earth conception. Even though they didn't want to talk about Earth conception, it sounds like it is, and he's made a beautiful picture.
Funny. I'll stick with that. But this experiential transformative act that culminates with you as the person who experiences it went through this process of formalization in the process of creating this orthodoxy. There was a great deal of diversity in early Christianity. There were different groups. And there were even higher teachings, higher mysteries, the Gnostics considered, for the mature Christians reported to have, you know, teachings and mysteries that weren't even for your basic run-of-the-mill initiated Christian. And so there was this attempt to formalize, create a structure, create a doctrine that would enable someone to be a Christian from one end of the Mediterranean to the other, believing the same doctrines, not being led astray, which was the great fear of Irenaeus, that these people were being led astray, and instead to have an orthodox way and understanding. Where that leads to is this more and more formalization, a linear removing of oneself further and further from the story, so it becomes more and more distant history. There's a greater filter of understanding between you and the story as time goes on. There are commentaries, there are theological understandings, there are ways in which the stories are combined, like the ways in which the four Gospels are combined at Christmas and Easter. And so we see through these filters, and also the meanings of the words. They are understood in a particular way. And it's hard to try to even begin to see them in a different way. Like turn the other cheek. There are lots of ways to see that phrase. It doesn't have to be a command that you are required to do. It doesn't have to be necessarily a meek command either. There is an interpretation where it's very much an in-your-face kind of gesture. But it's hard for us to even consider those because of all these centuries, this linear movement away from the story, through doctrine, through this process of orthodoxy. And what you end up with at our current end of the process, so many ways, something so abstract and removed that there is no experience really left to it. It's been rationalized and given a form that is abstract and objective and historical, and the subjective, the experiential, has been taken away. The sola scriptura, radical Protestantism, where you just have the word read to you or are being preached at, or the very stripped down, rationalized, minimized Mass, Eucharist, that is present in many traditions. And so you end up without any access to the original story. And you are, in effect, 2,000 years away from it now. You can't get to it again. So one of the missing things from what is missing, what we are seeking to include, is ourselves, is our experience. Being able to reconnect to the story and live it out and see its meaning unfold in us. And that is the living quality of a sacred story. What you must connect to in order for it to really have that life, to really have that movement. If it isn't something that you connect with in that way, then it is perhaps the structure of the universe, structure of understanding, or frame of understanding. If it doesn't have that motive force, it doesn't have that compelling quality to it, it doesn't carry you forward. There have been different articulations and ways of trying to reach to this. And you can look at even the attempt to frame through Protestantism to the end of Protestantism as a personal relationship with Christ, as being an attempt to get back to that original experience. That there is, even through this historical process and this 2,000-year separation, there's then an attempt to get back to that story, to one's own experience. And this is something that has slowly been filtered out of our consciousness and out of our culture. One of the things that strikes me as being so odd is this: the common understanding of religion is something objective, something that you can have without any members of. No members of the religion still have religion. Either that you can encompass a religion in a book or in a set of beliefs or practices, that it doesn't necessarily include the subjective or the transformative, personal. And this has essentially caused a split in our cultural landscape where we see a difference between the spiritual and the religious. Spiritual might still be alive, might still be a pulse there, But the religious, as far as most people see it, doesn't have one anymore. It's just become the static skeleton thing that frames in perhaps understanding, or merely is some sort of a structural cage that keeps you from experience. Comments on that? It makes sense? Disagree with that? Vehemently disagree? Come on. The other thing that we must bear in mind when we are looking at sacred stories and looking at the meaning of sacred stories is not only the distance between us and them, but also what happened before preceding stories, because they give shape to the story itself. Stories aren't told to people who don't understand them. You have to understand the story in order to receive it and pass it on. If it is completely new, completely abstract, completely alien, it's gone. People just go, huh, and walk off. It has to be something that resonates with what is currently there. And so, in the story of Christianity, the story of Christ, takes its form from what was there previously. And the filters, previous expectation, become a form of that story, and then filter through it into all the commentary and stuff since then. And so what we have, the story of the Gospels, we have 12 disciples, because previously there were 12 tribes. And we have these forming and framing of things to echo and mirror what happened before. Maybe that John the Baptist was doing what he was doing as a ritualized form of the Exodus, the crossing the Red Sea. And there are so many other indications in these stories that are seen as being fulfilling prophecy. That is to say, they are echoing previous stories that are occurring in the culture, and they shape the way people are seeing even current events. So the way in which Jesus was understood, one of them was as an apocalyptic preacher, because there were apocalyptic preachers around. If you see somebody walking around with a bunch of followers, what are you going to think? Apocalyptic preacher. So, the stories previously are in a continuum with whatever occurs. Just as the other forms and stories, the ones in the mystery traditions, mystery religions, also became a part of the Christian story. And then all of those go forward from there. This has shaped the way in which these stories have been viewed for all of this time. To view them in that way is to make particular assumptions. And one of them will make particular assumptions about is Mary Magdalene. To look at the Gospels, to see the 12 mentioned again and again as disciples, and later as apostles, one replacement, is to leave out this other figure. And the only place really where she enters into the story, and does so in a very odd way, is at the resurrection. She then leaves the story, as far as the canonical texts are concerned. So she becomes a very interesting figure. She becomes important to us, symbolic to us, as the lost, as she is merely hinted at. Her importance is shown at one point, pivotal, crucial point, and then lost again. So we're going to look at more next week. Is the role of Mary Magdalene in the myth, in the story,
the different ways in which we can look at her role in the Gospels, and also in some Gnostic texts afterwards, and the way in which she's looked at and understood in different ways today, one of them being in this bridal story. Hopefully, we can all make it next week, and we will see you then. And if there are any other questions or comments, feel free to shout them out.
Some of the brewer of these kinds of books, because the secular author writes about the sacred, so he has no plausibility. But the theologian is known by stories, not stories. And I'm kind of thinking about Cousin Socrates in his book, The Demonstration of Christ. And Cousin Rick, or as though only the theologians could presume they could know what Christ was reading.
Yes, and also it's part of this 2,000 year filter that you then have to become some sort of a specialist to be then qualified to comment on the story, right? You have to be familiar with the 2,000 years of commentary more than just the story itself. And Kazantzakis was definitely reaching back to the experience in a very real way. He made Christ very real, troubled person with a mission, and very human, and got in a lot of trouble, but not as much as the film got in it. And that comes down to the way in which people frame these stories and tell other people about the stories. And that's how we sort of see the world today, the sort of propagandized view of things, so that every story has its frame, and we have these meme factories of think tanks creating ways in which to look at everything from their particular way, and then you have what you think is objective data, but you're understanding it in the form of a story in a frame in a particular way. And the way in which the Last Temptation of Christ was portrayed as being Jesus and Mary have sex, right? Whereas that's a very small part of this movie, and actually is a very rich part of the story, because it's the temptation. It's a part of the temptation, and he overcomes the temptation. So if you actually look at the story, it's one which, most of the people for whom the story resonates, if they weren't afraid of anybody touching the story, would probably be able to engage in and appreciate at some level. But the way in which it was framed and sold to people was as an attack on the story. And that's really the way in which they framed and sold the Da Vinci Code, both for and against, because it got them to sell a lot of books and stirred up a lot of controversy and so forth. But yeah, the sacrosanct nature of the story is just a part of that forming of any kind of an orthodoxy. Then you have to have this protected area of doctrine, and you then build upon the protected area, and you keep making your choices and deciding what goes in and what goes out. And you have to grow that up, and anybody who then wants to revisit any of these previous decisions, it's a big no-no, because you're opening up everything afterwards. And so revisiting the initial story is the biggest no-no, because that opens up everything. And that's part of the cure over the Gospel of Judas and so forth, because any modification of the original stories in the Gospels will lead to huge furor, because that would mean opening up every council, everything thereafter, just chaos in their view of things. What's that? Yes. Before we go away, I wanted to get to one other thing.
Sorry, when you say you're down in the Gnostic text, is there a Gnostic text?
There's the Gospel of Mary, and then she's mentioned in the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas.
So that one would be my
Yeah.
one of the things that I don't want to swing by without revisiting and are looking at uniting opposites is to look at this dichotomy here between the formalized and the experienced approach to things. Because if you just take either one, you end up really going too far in either direction. Formalized, you end up with just this form, this abstract thing that you can't experience. If you go off the experienced only, then it's really hard to help anybody else follow along behind you or help anybody else along beside you. Because you can get things too idiosyncratic, they're too personal. Symbols are too personal, too individual. So, when seeking for this lost other, point is to not switch so we just have the other one, just have experience. But to unite them in that union of opposites and to move beyond to a new form, to a new experience that includes an understanding, a container, a story, a way in which you can understand the experience, but also is open to the experience. That's really what I try to do in our tradition, is to have a tradition, have a form, but it is a form in which something is intended to happen, an experience can occur that can take you back to the original point, the origin of the story, original transformation, and include you as a part of that. And whatever form you find in spirituality, something to seek. This integration, transformation, and ultimately transcendence. Thanks. Any other comments? I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. Please send your questions, comments, or suggestions to RevTroy@gnosis.org. Thank you. Information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at Gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG. Thank you.
Wake up.